hello and welcome to another episode of Radio War Nerd. The date today is June 26th, 2025, and this is episode 533. I am the co-host Mark Ames in the Greater Rochester area of Western New York. You're listening to Radio War Nerd. Subscribe at patreon.com/Radio War Nerd. And I'm on the line, of course, with the Warner, John Dolan, a.k.a. Gary Brecher. You're still in Cancun. Are you going to be there for much longer?
About 5 hours.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we are on the road again. And that song has been echoing in my head every time with a curse to Willie Nilsson.
Like, I know, which is too bad. He's written a lot of great songs. That one wasn't one of them, or at least it was made for hell.
Yeah. I guess if all you need is a joint, then any place is fine.
Yeah. I always love that Sam Kinison line where Willie Nilsson's like, "Oh, great. I owe Texas. Great. Let's go play Texas again." No, Willie, you owe taxes, not Texas. You pot smoker. Yeah. Anyways. Right. So we have a great interview today with Ori Goldberg and on both the Iran war from the Israeli perspective, from his perspective in Israel, that is to say, also about the Israeli perspective, and on the genocide in Gaza. And I think we should just get straight to this interview. It's really good. And
it really is.
Yeah, so let's get straight to our interview with Ori Goldberg. Okay, we are very honored to have with us our guest today, Ori Goldberg. Ori is a former university professor. He's written extensively on Iran, Israel, and the relationship between religion and politics in the Middle East. Ori is based in Herzliya. And first of all, Ori, thanks for coming on Radio War Nerd.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. I'm honored.
Okay, thanks. I heard Ori's interview. I heard your interview on a friend of the show, J.G. Michael's podcast, Parallax View. And I was very intense, I thought, very and moving, and you know, we've had since the genocide began, we've had several guests on. We've talked about it a lot. We've had on Muin Rabbani, we've had on people from Electronic Intifada, we had on Anthony Lowenstein, but we haven't had an Israeli on, and in a lot of our discussions with or without guests, we're always kind of trying to make sense of Israeli politics, the Israeli mindset, and so on. And so that when I heard you talking, I thought I really wanted to get you on the show so that our listeners could hear your perspective on this and other things as well. So I think because you're also an Iran expert and in Israel, I think maybe we could just start with the war, that this 12-day war that just happened, that is currently in a state of ceasefire. I've seen that you've already written some articles on it, but if you could explain your take from Israel, what the war accomplished, why the war was launched, and then we can talk a little bit more about it as well, like the Iranian missiles and stuff. But first, what the point of the war was and what was or wasn't accomplished.
Sure. Happy to. I don't think the war was about Iran, to be quite frank, certainly not from the Israeli side. And I base my conclusion on the fact that Israel didn't really have any defined goals for this war. Not even semi-fictitious ones like destroy Hamas and get the hostages back, which is what happened when Israel began to carpet bomb Gaza, the very beginning of the genocide. In Iran's case, it was more like Israel just put a hand into a hat full of the most lame cliches and randomly pulled out whatever whatever came out, and pretended to act on that, because it was clear that Israel couldn't do significant damage to the Iranian nuclear program on its own. You didn't have to be an expert on that. Everybody who knows anything basically said that to do real damage, you have to hit the stockpile of uranium, mm-hmm. enriched uranium that Iran would use. And that stockpile is kept deep underground, and Israel doesn't have the MOPs, the bunker busting bombs needed to hit that deep. And the other trope that we heard repeatedly was regime change. Mm-hmm. But even that wasn't really uttered seriously by anybody, because Israel didn't exactly do anything that would have brought about regime change. I think the best way to describe the official Israeli state of mind is to quote Homer Simpson, who said, when you
we
don't
do that
know
a
what
lot
to do,
we quote him a lot here, so yeah, yeah. So, go ahead.
I like, when you don't know what to do, do what you know.
yeah, that's good. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Israel knows how to assassinate senior enemy leaders, which is what it did mostly. I mean, I think the aerial bombardment of the first 48 hours was mostly meant as cover for Mossad and for local Iranian operatives to assassinate the senior command of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Mm-hmm. And then Israel just sort of bombed, not at random, but, you know, in a very, I don't want to use an adjective to be too pejorative, but let's talk for a second about the bombing of Evin prison in Tehran, which is the main political prison where the political prisoners are kept and tortured. Israel bombed the entrance to Evin prison and maybe killed like a prosecutor in the prison, but mostly hurt the prisoners, made their conditions in the prison worse. Nobody escaped, and certainly no revolution grew from the bombing of Evin. Israel bombed the infamous clock in a Tehran square that counted down to 2040 when Israel would be destroyed. Lots of stuff like that. Now, Israel demonstrated terrific tactical prowess and achieved aerial superiority over Tehran and over Iran, broadly speaking, very, very quickly. But let me quote again, but this time from Alice in Wonderland, that famous scene where Alice is asking the Cheshire Cat for instructions. And he asks her where she wants to go, and she says she doesn't really care. And so he replies by saying, if you don't know where you want to go, it doesn't matter which way you take. Mm-hmm. And Israel didn't really have any kind of vision about where it wanted to go.
The bombing was the point, basically?
Yeah. The point was to say, we can do whatever we want.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And directly related to that, the point was to rally the world behind Israel to the extent that the world would recognize Israel's absolute right to do whatever it wants, whenever it wants, to whoever it wants, you know, without paying any sort of price or suffering any sort of consequence.
Israel seems to have paid a price. Did they count on that, the intensity of the Iranian missile response?
That's a very good question. I'm not sure they did, actually. And I also wouldn't put it past Israeli authorities concealing some of the damage that the Iranians inflicted, because living here, I can tell you that not only were the Iranians able to launch missiles directly at the Israeli heartland, but they know exactly where the strategic installations are. And they had good intel, and they fired and they hit where they wanted to hit.
There were rumors that the Mossad head was killed in Iranian bombing?
Don't think that's true, at least not the best of my knowledge. Although, you know, if we're going to go all conspiratorial, I don't think he's been seen recently. But the Iranians know very well where Mossad headquarters is, and they knew how to launch missiles that were, let's say politely, not very far, that hit not very far from there. Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting point about the Iranian missiles is the Israeli public's willingness to take the hits, you know, to take a licking and keep on ticking as a demonstration of national resilience and unity. And in a way, the Israeli public was as hungry for a win as Netanyahu and IDF Chief of Staff Zamir were, because the past nearly 2 years now have really been just a series of abject failures for Israel and Gaza. I'm not even talking about the moral implications of the genocide. I'm talking about the fact that Israel has occupied Gaza numerous times already and has retreated and has bombed and has demolished and has done everything within its power and more, starved the Gazans, and it has not managed to meet the goals that it set itself 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So this was a big deal. We needed a win, and an entire generation of Israelis, and by that I mean time-wise. I have my eldest, my daughter, is going to turn 22 in July. She's never known an Israel that was not led by Netanyahu, except for like an 18-month hiatus. And she and her younger brothers grew up knowing that Iran was our existential enemy, and at some point we would go to war with Iran and we would win. That's how the Israeli government is spinning what happened in Iran. But I think that version of events is very much unsubstantiated from pretty much every direction you choose to look at it, from the efficacy of the strikes on the nuclear installations to the sum total of what Israel managed to achieve. Maybe the most succinct way of putting it is to say that really Israel won the tactical battle, but has no idea what the strategic war was about.
Isn't that, that seems to be a running theme with Israel and with assassinations. And I know you've written about Israel and it's kind of the Israeli kind of political military classes, obsession or fixation on assassinations almost as an end among themselves. And we've talked about it on this show. We've talked about Ronan Bergman's book, Rise and Kill First, where they are really good at assassinations. I mean, they're very effective at assassinations. And we saw this again. We've seen this in the last 2 years. I mean, they've killed the senior leadership of Hamas wherever. They killed Nasrallah and top Hezbollah people. That was actually did make an impact. And they wiped out a large portion of Iran's military command, especially the Revolutionary Guard's military command and nuclear scientists. But it hasn't changed anything. Could you explain maybe the It seems to me that the ability to assassinate is its own political end, or and trying to make sense of why Israel does it, where the tactic is divorced from the strategy. It seems like
I'm happy to try and ruminate on it for a second, but before I do that, I want to say that you raise, I think, a point that is very important, not in terms of assassinations or Israeli strategy, but in terms of the effect that listening to official Israeli spokespersons has on a person who doesn't necessarily buy the Israeli version. And Israeli officials are relentless in their conviction that the truth that they are telling you is the only truth. And they're so relentless and they're so intense that very often, even if you are knowledgeable about this or you've interviewed them repeatedly, I've had this conversation with journalists from all over the world over the past 2 weeks, you reach a point where you start to doubt yourself. Mm-hmm. And you say, hey, if they keep saying this and they're so convinced that it's true and it makes such intuitive sense to them, maybe I'm the crazy one.
Right.
And it's really important to say, right at the start of our conversation, you're not the crazy one. When you look at assassinations and you say, why are you doing this? It doesn't change anything. You're absolutely right. It doesn't change anything. You said that the case of Hezbollah in Lebanon was an exception, and it was to some extent because Nasrallah really was kind of a supreme leader. But Nasrallah's assassination, it wasn't really the sort of assassination Israel usually carries out. Israel prided itself on the excellent intelligence it employed in Lebanon. But if you look at Israel's most quote-unquote successful operations, they were basically mass killings. They were just unleashing a very brute power, both on the Dahiya neighborhood in Beirut, where Nasrallah had his headquarters, but also the infamous Biber attack.
Yeah,
this was Israel just unleashing indiscriminate power and celebrating the results as though there was some unbelievably creative solution to the Israeli problem. Nothing about this was creative. It was very, very blunt and very overt. So I think, and that's the case in Lebanon, by the way. Why do Israelis like assassinations? Part of it has to do with this tactical mindset. We're not good at strategic planning. And maybe the reason we're not good at strategic planning is because the Israeli political echelons are reticent about setting clear strategic goals. And the reason for this reticence is that Israel is constantly aware that its military demeanor is corroborated and underpinned by basic assumptions that are problematic at best. You know, let's say Israeli security doctrine would say Israel will defend its borders at all costs. What are Israel's borders? How do you define success and failure with that sort of mission? Now, Israeli politicians know this. And because they know this, they don't encourage strategy. And they like the tactical mindset because it's very immediate and accessible. You don't need to explain long-term regional sustainability. What you do is you make things blow up. And, of course, you also kill people. I mean, and when you kill people, you perpetuate the notion that this is basically a comic book story. That this is, you know, part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You got your
right,
good guys,
with a page of mugshots and a red X over every one of them, one after another. And this reminds me very much of something that seemed anomalous from the beginning of this most recent war on Iran. That is the obsession in Netanyahu's speeches with killing Khamenei. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name properly. Killing the Grand Ayatollah in Iran, because he seemed like one of the less charismatic figures in recent Iranian history compared to Khomeini or Ahmadinejad. And yet, before the attack on Iran, Netanyahu said over and over, if we kill this guy, the regime will end.
You know what? I'm not sure it was actually Netanyahu who said that. I think it was Minister of Defense Katz. Was asked directly if Israel was going to... Netanyahu was asked, I think it was in an interview for ABC or something, he was asked whether an assassination of Khamenei wouldn't cause an escalation in the conflict. And he said, what? No, it would end the conflict. And it was Defense Minister Katz who kept talking about how Khamenei didn't have the right to live. And now, you can look at that as an obsession, but I would propose that whatever Israel talks loudly about is its least likely course of action.
The old Maskarovka stuff.
Maskarovka,
yes. It isn't that Israel would not have liked to have hit Khamenei, but it was very clear that Iran was prepared for Khamenei to die. And talking about his assassination was, again, a way of trying to present Iran as a kind of a North Korea-style one-man dictatorship, which it really isn't. you know, even with regard to the Supreme Leader, who, by the way, is 86 and suffers from prostate cancer. And so a lot of this, I'm going to say something that is not very sophisticated, but a lot of the Israeli justifications were just incredibly crude. You know, there was nothing particularly sophisticated about anything that happened in this war. Sometimes they were outright lies, like the notion that this was a preventive strike because there was an imminent threat days away from Iran. That's very obviously a non-truth, if you will.
Right.
And I understand that IDF Chief Zamil today said that Israel was facing a seven-front war that was imminent and would have broken out in days, orchestrated by Iran. Israel has been trying to ascribe the Hamas massacre on October 7th, 2023, to Iranian planning. Generally, there's this whole Israeli hypothesis that Iran is the snake's head or the octopus's head, depending on who's using the analogy, which basically means that Iran's planning everything, and anything that happens in Lebanon or Yemen or Gaza is a diabolical plan hatched in Iran, which, to my understanding of Iran and of estimates by the great majority of intelligence organizations around the world, is just not true.
There's a lot of people in this country and in Washington, let's say, and in the foreign policy class who do ascribe to that theory too. They love that theory, actually. It's cleaner. You know, it's a lot cleaner.
You guys have a long memory with Iran. You remember Desert Eagle.
Yep.
But Trump, you know, during his first term, he surrounded himself with regime changers. Mm-hmm. You had your John Bolton and you had your Mike Pompeo. Part of it had to do, I think, with Trump being beholden to the evangelicals, who were big on regime change, because they supposedly were crucial in his winning the election in 2016. Yes. This was not the case in 2024. Trump did not appoint regime changers to man the senior positions in his national security establishment.
There's been a big fight over that, actually, within Washington. You might have followed this. Yeah, a lot of controversy, a lot of attempts to get people fired. But he dismissed his national security chief. And yet he bombed anyway. And he bombed anyway. I mean, I was going to ask you, was one of the goals to get one of Netanyahu's goals or the Israeli government's goals to get America directly involved? Was that, like, why bomb then? Was that one of the goals, or was it domestic politics? Like, people have tried to understand it more, because I think a lot of people also agree with you that the stated goals were bullshit.
I think definitely Netanyahu wanted to get the United States involved, but I don't think Netanyahu got what he bargained for. Mm-hmm. Because this wasn't a passionate espousal of the Israeli cause. This was a very, very, you know, limited, constrained surgical strike, and apparently it wasn't that successful. Mm-hmm. You know, it was what it was, I think, and again, I think this is very much Trumpian. Trump wanted to appear strong, wanted to appear commander in chief. Maybe this has something to do with the No Kings parades his infamous birthday parade with the squeaking tank. But I think he also wanted, because this is Trump, he wanted a Star Wars moment. Yes. This was what the strike on Fordow basically was.
Yeah.
And, you know, they dropped the bombs, and next thing you knew, they were back. The B-2s were back in Missouri. So we're not talking about, we're not talking about what Joe Biden did. You know, Trump helped, but Trump did very, very little when you compare the commitment and the assistance that the United States under Biden had for Israel during the genocide. Mm-hmm. And I think Trump doesn't really care. And I think he said as much, you know, when he said, we may be talking to the Iranians next week. We might have a deal. I don't know. They should go back to their own world, do whatever they're doing. I don't think Trump cares. I think what Trump was doing was testing Netanyahu. He wanted to see what Netanyahu will be able to do if he gives him carte blanche. And if what Netanyahu did would work out for Trump, would be successful, then Trump would happily leverage it. By the way, the American strike on the Iranian installation sends a message not just to the world with regard to Israel, but to the Gulf monarchies. Mm-hmm. I think people in Saudi Arabia and the UAE sleep easier knowing that when push comes to shove, Trump will be willing to attack in Iran.
Right.
Yeah. So,
and those are big checkbook powers, yeah. So he would want to keep them happy. Yeah.
They are Trump's true strategic partners, not Israel.
Yeah. Yeah, he was just there, a month or two ago, mm-hmm. collecting giant pledges of, in the trillions.
And he makes a gazillion dollars off numerous deals with them right now when he's in the White House. So, So all in all, Netanyahu gambled, and Netanyahu has been so effusive in his thanks to Trump that it really is pathetic at this point. But I don't think Netanyahu got what he bargained for. And by the way, I don't think Trump likes Netanyahu. Mm-hmm. You guys remember the cartoon, I think it was from the New York Times, that showed Netanyahu walking Trump on a leash during his first term?
No, I don't remember that, but I'm sure Trump remembers it.
He would never forget that. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Trump remembers that, no doubt.
Yeah, I remember they had problems back in 2020 that went out into the open. It was very open that Trump disliked Netanyahu and they disliked each other. Mm-hmm. So, which is why I was very surprised that the pro-Israel crowd, I don't know about in Israel itself, but certainly here, the pro-Israel crowd was very, very much for Trump and against Kamala Harris, which seemed to me kind of part and parcel of kind of the crazy stupidity of the Israel crowd of the last few years, because they never had a greater pushover than Biden-Harris in their history, as far as I could tell.
You're absolutely right.
And Trump is mercurial, as they say. I mean, he's vain on a scale that you can't fully control it. And I'm sure Harris would have been, as much of a pushover because of always worrying about being seen as weak or not pro-Israel enough. If she had won, she probably would have put Liz Cheney in as National Security Council chief or advisor. And, but that's what they thought. And now they have Trump sort of imposing bombing, and they thought, oh, great, it's paid off. But then he sort of imposed a ceasefire. And it seems to me that the pro-Israel crowd here, at least, is very kind of they're kind of grumbling. Oh, okay, yeah, that's okay. But they don't seem particularly satisfied by it.
I think you've hit on a point that is broader than just Trump and the strike on Iran. Trump is mercurial and vain and not the sharpest pencil in the pencil box, but genocide, carrying out a genocide, is not just wrong, and it also makes you stupid. If you perpetrate a genocide for long enough, you start seeing the world two-dimensionally. You lack depth. Now, Israel was never great on strategic depth anyway, but after nearly 2 years of genocide, remember when I talked a little just previously about how crude Israeli reasoning was? Mm-hmm. This isn't just identity politics, what you're talking about when you're talking about the American pro-Israel crowd. This is crude identity politics. This is, very low quality costumes, very rapidly sewn up for Halloween. You know, Republicans good, Democrats bad, military involvement good, strategy bad, whatever. Kamala is a crazy left-winger Californian, whereas Trump is, you know, a true representative of the American heartland. None of that stuff means anything anymore. And again, in a world that is made in the image of a genocide, that is, I think, a very, very serious and long-term residual effect. Words and concepts lose their meaning. You know, I'll take a sharp turn for a second. Let's talk about, in the framework of Israelis and Palestinians. The Israeli left used to talk about peace. You know, how are we going to make peace between Israelis and Palestinians? What does peace mean after a genocide? Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a war. What does it mean when Israelis say too many Gazan innocents have been killed? If it's a genocide, then everybody is a victim of a genocide. You know, it's not about whether you deserved it or not, because if you assume that some people deserve to die in a genocide, you're kind of justifying the genocide. And if you find yourself at the end, which is the situation in Israel, and I would assume probably in the United States and the UK as well, if you find yourself at the end having a discussion that could be entitled genocide, yes or no, then things don't mean anything anymore.
Yeah. What has the Israeli left been doing while Gaza was unfolding? I mean, do they still exist?
What is the Israeli left right now?
There are, I would say, thousands of people maybe who share my opinions, and we're called radical leftists. But the establishment left, the Zionist left, which has always been big on former generals and on appearing security conscious so as not to drive away right-wing nationalistic voters, they've criticized Netanyahu for not bringing the hostages back home, but for a very long time, they did not call for an end to the genocide. Of course, they don't call it a genocide. They call it the war. But they didn't call for it to end. They couldn't. As far as they were concerned, they were in a political double bind. If they called for an end to the war, then they would be seen as dewy-eyed bleeding hearts. Mm. So they had to, they didn't say fight on, but they didn't call for an end to the war. So what they ended up with, as far as their position goes, was a paradox. On the one hand, bring the hostages back home, which everybody knew had to be carried out through a deal with Hamas. On the other hand, reject any attempt to deal with Hamas and maybe not talk about Hamas's destruction, but not mention what was happening in Gaza. So I think a lot of Israelis took a good look at the Israeli center left and came to the conclusion that they were pale epigons of the original Netanyahu. And why vote for, you know, the epigons when you can vote for the original?
Sounds familiar.
So I bet.
but Israeli politics in general, though, have moved within the Israeli spectrum, at least let's say if we take the spectrum from 1970 or something to today. I mean, it's moved so far to the right, hasn't it? So when you say center left, it's well to the right of where it was. I mean, could you describe, I guess, Israeli politics today and what Netanyahu's like, what his support is, and what do the Israelis think of the genocide? Because I've been seeing polls, we've talked about them, where a huge majority of Israelis are basically for expelling, or, you know, however possible, Arabs, at least either from Palestinians from Gaza or from all the lands of greater Israel.
I'd like to divide my answer into two parts.
Okay.
The movement to the right, I think, could probably best be described as a situation where our collective id and our collective superego have changed places. You know, all the stuff we never felt comfortable talking about, and the stuff that we repressed, the knowledge of the atrocities of the Nakba in 1948 and the general state of racism in this country and all those things that we felt we could downplay and sort of get everybody to go along with us. They were the quiet parts. We started saying them out loud after October 7th. And then any notion of commitment or obligation to rules that didn't have anything to do with, they started on October 7th, they deserve whatever's coming to them. That was hushed up very quickly and very powerfully. And you know how old-time grandmothers would say to their grandchildren, would warn them not to frown because the frown would stick on their face. Yeah. They'd mm-hmm. never smile again. So we kind of stayed like that. Any respect we had for international law, for international standards, even any thought we had about any commitment we had to our own international stature, that was tossed by the roadside. You know, we were starting to say the quiet parts out loud and we didn't care. We were taking responsibility. We were finally telling the truth. And in that sense, even though there's a difference between Israelis, you know, there are settlers on the Israeli right who celebrated this and saw it as a deliverance and as proof that they were, that they'd always been right and that God was watching over Israel. And, you know, there are people like me, Israelis who grew up in what we call a secular household, very statist, very, you know, team players, very, very patriotic. And there's like a difference between the way people like me and people like the settlers approach to genocide. They've got a lot of religious rhetoric going on and God directly involved. And I don't have all of that, but most of the people like me would maybe avert their gaze, but when asked directly what they thought should be done about the genocide, they said, do you have a better proposal? Mm. You know, mm-hmm. do you have a better idea of what Israel can do? Which all amounts to the same thing, because this isn't about supporting a blockade or supporting BDS or whatever. This is about supporting a genocide. Mm. So I don't think Israeli politics moves so much to the right as much as a great many people suddenly found themselves saying out loud those things they had been taught for a very long time to keep suppressed. It's not that those things weren't there at the heart of the Israeli collective Israeli consciousness. They were. You just weren't supposed to say them.
Right.
Right.
But I remember the old sort of Israeli American consensus as being very sensitive to what they called world opinion. And this seems to involve a change to total scorn for world opinion.
When I write about it, I think of it as a solipsism, as the conviction that nothing is real except for us. And maybe I'll try and explain the trauma of October 7th, 23 in that respect. Look, life in Israel is based on Jewish superiority, Jewish supremacy. Mm-hmm. This is a Jewish state. We'd like to think of ourselves as a Jewish and democratic state, but it's not a real democracy for people who are not Jews, and it's not a real democracy for the subjects of the military dictatorship we maintain in the occupied Palestinian territories. So everything here is based on the notion that Jewish lives are worth more. I mean, look at instances of settler violence. Look at the horrific pogrom that took place yesterday. Mm-hmm. What happened? A group of settlers went into a Palestinian village and started burning structures and throwing rocks. And then the military was called. The military was supposed to defend the Palestinians, but the military started firing on the Palestinians and killed three young men. And that's because the Israeli military cannot, in any way anyone can grasp, shoot at settlers, because settlers are Jewish. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't even matter if the military supports the settler violence. Maybe it doesn't. But the situation in the West Bank is such that in any sort of a conflict between Jews and Palestinians, if the military gets called in, the military will defend the Jews. regardless of how egregious their crimes are. So all of it is based on Jewish supremacy. Let's use that word. Every fabric of life is created in that image. And we thought that we were going to make that an established fact. Netanyahu kept telling us and the rest of the world that he was on his way to normalizing Israel's status, that he would have an agreement with Saudi Arabia, that we would have peace, that we could travel anywhere we wanted, and effectively the Palestinian issue would be completely forgotten. We thought that was coming. We thought that was very near. And then came October 7th, when Hamas humiliated Israel. Both, you know, a military defeat and the mass slaughter of hundreds of Israelis. And the whole notion that we could maintain our supremacy by being good civilized folk, by doing things according to the rule book, that could no longer hold, you know? And we had to maintain our supremacy at all costs, because if we didn't, and that's a very basic Israeli belief, and all the Palestinians and all the other Arabs would gang up on us and throw us into the Mediterranean. So what we did almost immediately was lift all restraints, all disclaimers, all the rules that were meant to create some sort of balance, or at least the pretense of a balance, and just go in full throttle and do anything we wanted to do, anything we felt we had to do, and we would take instruction from absolutely no one. And we never even stopped for a breather. We never even stopped to bury our dead. We just you know, got in there and started carpet bombing the place. So that's what happened to the Israeli to Israeli discourse. That's what happened to Israeli politics.
Right.
There was no room for discourse anymore. You just had to be full throttle all the time.
How are you and people who see what's happening, like you, Israelis, Jewish Israelis, for that matter, even Arab Israelis, like how are you functioning in the current environment? I haven't really heard. In the early days, there was overt repression. I don't know if it's like that anymore, but how do you function in society like that? Do you have a community of like-minded people that help keep you sane, or how does it work?
Well, yeah, we like each other. Facebook is a big platform. We don't use Twitter. I don't tweet in Hebrew because Twitter is fully dominated by much more hateful discourse. We use Facebook, and we talk to each other on occasion, and we're there, but we're very much alone, and we keep most of our relationships virtual at the moment. All of us have had our hearts broken repeatedly and continuously by a really, really large number of people we thought were our friends, people we thought were like-minded, and a lot of us are shell-shocked. We don't want to talk to people. Mm-hmm. Right. And as far as the other way around goes, I think most Israelis who don't share my opinions, they don't even think of me as a traitor. They just think I'm crazy.
Wow.
So I don't get threats or many vicious emails. They just don't feel I'm worth their time.
You get off on insanity, huh?
Yeah, precisely. I'm locked just the way I think they're solipsistic, and they've willfully detached themselves from the world, which is one very useful definition of crazy. They think that I have, for whatever reason, either I'm being paid or I'm just insane or whatever, I've chosen to completely deny reality. Like, as we're talking, I get push notices from Haaretz and places like that. And apparently what Netanyahu has just said is that the historic victory in Iran is opening up opportunities for expanding Israel's peace agreements. Remember, we just talked about peace. I assume he's talking about Syria, because Ashara seems to be willing to talk about an agreement like that. But at the same time, I don't know if you heard about this, Trump went on record as saying Israel should stop Netanyahu's trial.
Right. Yes, I saw he just did that. Yeah.
Yeah, he that was one of his heartfelt tweets. Like, yes. I don't know why it is, but I just feel real solidarity with this guy.
Yes. The smart money, you know, if I was to bet on this, I wouldn't bet on many countries signing peace agreements with Israel, with the exception of Syria. But I would bet on a deal that Trump or his people are concocting that would end the war in Gaza and end his trial. There would be a plea bargain or an amnesty or whatever. And I understand he's been invited to the White House, which to me says exactly one thing. Trump has had enough.
Yeah.
He doesn't want this anymore. He doesn't want to be associated with it. He doesn't care. He wants Netanyahu to stop. So he's maybe cajoling him or, you know, trying to kill him with honey. Mm-hmm. But he's had enough. Now, Netanyahu is spinning this again as a move that indicates unbelievable strategic foresight on his part. That's about as lame as bombing Evin prison. But Israelis are buying this. You know, Israelis are saying, even people on the left. I just saw an editorial that Gideon Levy, who is Haaretz's token, like real leftist, wrote. And he said, you got to hand it to Netanyahu. He knew how to fight this war. It doesn't matter if this war was necessary or not, but he knew when to go in and he knew when to get out. As though the date and the timing of getting out was up to Netanyahu.
Right. Right. That's disappointing of Gideon Levy. Yeah.
Well, do you see this sort of frenzy as ebbing? I mean, most frenzies ebb in time. What happens afterwards?
Really bad things. The Israeli economy is already imploding. The Israeli political system, the right is constantly trying to push its anti-democratic measures, you know, to stifle the courts and do all sorts of things like that. And even, but everybody seems to agree, for example, that what we need is more soldiers. Why do we need more soldiers? Because we're going to be fighting a forever war. Mm-hmm. So really bad things are going to happen. And the reason Israel is not in a frenzy now. It has been in a frenzy for some time, but I wish I could say, okay, I wish that was a good thing. It's not a good thing. Israel is so thoroughly fatigued, but it is so thoroughly committed. It has gambled everything it has on Trump, on being able to maintain this presence in who knows how many countries simultaneously, on devoting all of its resources to its military power so it can respond and attack and do whatever it wants whenever it wants, because that's how we feel secure. We don't have any resources left for anything else. You know, prices here have been rising at a hysterical rate, which is not true for wages. The cost of real estate is spiking, going through the roof. I'm trying to think about things that demonstrate what I'm talking about, perhaps even more effectively. Restaurants are closing in their dozens, droves and droves, because you can't go out anymore because things cost too much. Mediocre stuff costs too much, not the good stuff. You can't live here. It's very difficult to live. It's very difficult to find something that makes life bearable and that isn't, you know, military service and more historic victories. But Israel is all in. Israel can't really get out. Mm-hmm. So either Trump has his way and he manages to do this thing where Israel rids itself of Netanyahu and ends the war in Gaza and then opens the way up for the rest of the world to pull off a Marshall Plan-like settlement. Or maybe Trump stops caring before that happens, or maybe the rest of the world steps up. But so far, the rest of the world is not very eager to step up. And I don't blame the rest of the world, because who wants to cooperate with Israel?
So you're talking about, you know, how this ends. I mean, how do you see any possibility of a positive solution? That is to say, either a single state where everybody has democratic rights, like what happened in South Africa, or as some people still cling to, a two-state solution of some kind. Is there any possibility, or what could bring that about?
Those are two separate questions. I can't act in this reality. I can't survive in this reality if I'm prevented from believing that there is some kind of positive ending. For me, that positive ending is the one state, not the two states. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't really matter. It's more about the conviction that there can be a positive ending. What can bring it about? I don't know if it can be brought about now. I think Israel is going to have to be forced to take a very lengthy time out, sit alone in the dark, deal with its own internal affairs, watch the economy, again, potentially implode, get it through our thick skulls that a forever war impacts our lives, even though we try to make believe that our bourgeois fantasies have nothing to do with security considerations. And only when we come to that realization, which can only be superimposed on us by outside forces, will we be capable of considering any kind of change. I don't think we're there. And I think the only way we'll get there is if we are, at least for a little while, cast into the outer darkness.
Yeah, well, even though that sounds like one of the speeches by Milton's Fallen Angels, it seems nice and conclusive. I don't know, maybe Mark, shall we finish there?
Sure, yeah, I think we could finish here. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us, Ori. We'd love to talk with you again sometime in the near future as well. This story's not going away. I mean, that's the thing about genocide that, that Jews of all people should know is that stain doesn't go away. It's yeah. like, you know, that's, and it, whether you're a diaspora Jew or an Israeli, even if you're an anti-Zionist diaspora Jew, it doesn't matter. It stays with you.
Yeah. You'd think they know, but and I'd be very happy to talk to you guys about that. I'm thinking about that. I have been thinking about that for some time. I just had one thought that I already mentioned during our conversation, but I think it's a really essential point, is that, you know, when we talk about genocide, we talk about the horror of genocide, and we talk about what a glimpse it grants us into, you know, the darkness of human consciousness and the horrific parts of the human soul and all that. And all that's true. But we also need to remember how dumb and indifferent and insensitive and dehumanized genocide makes the people who perpetrate it. After nearly 2 years of genocide, if I can say one very prominent thing about Israelis, it's not that we're all evil, because there are different kinds of evil, and there are some good people, and there's religious evil and secular evil and all kinds. But we are all very, very stupid. We're all very much oblivious to everything that's happening around us. If I'm polite, I'll call it solipsistic. If I'm less polite, I'll say that we are a society of zombies at the moment. And who knows if there's a cure for that condition. Genocide makes you into a zombie.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so I think we can end it there. Thank you again so much, Ori Goldberg, for coming on Radio War Nerd.
It was my pleasure, and I'll be happy to talk with you guys at, you know, whenever you want.
Great.
All right.
Appreciate it. Okay, thank you, everyone. Thanks, John, Brendan, and our guest, Ori Goldberg, and talk to everyone soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
Bye.